Rumpelstiltskin. Long ago, in a kingdom far away, there lived a miller who was very economically disadvantaged. This miller shared his humble dwelling with his only daughter, an independent young woman named Esmeralda. Now, the miller was very ashamed of his poverty. Rather than angry at the economic system that had marginalized him, and was always searching for a way to get rich quick. "If only I could get my daughter to marry a rich man," he mused, in a sexist and archaic way. "She'll be fulfilled, and I'll never have to work another day in my life." To this shabby end, he had an inspiration. He would start a rumor that his daughter was able to spin common barnyard straw into pure gold. With this untruth, he would be able to attract the attention of many rich men and marry off Esmeralda. The rumor spread through the kingdom in a manner that just happened to be like wildfire, and soon reached the prince. As greedy and gullible as most men of his station, he believed the rumor and invited Esmeralda to his castle for a May Day festival. But when she arrived, he had her thrown into a dungeon filled with straw and ordered her to spin it into gold. Locked in the dungeon, fearing for her life, Esmeralda sat on the floor and wept. Never had the exploitativeness of the patriarchy been made so apparent to her. As she cried, a diminutive man in a funny hat appeared in the dungeon.
"Why are you crying, my dear?"
he asked. Esmeralda was startled, but answered him,
"The prince has ordered me to spin all this straw into gold."
"But why are you crying?"
he asked again.
"Because it can't be done. What, are you specially abled or something?"
The differently statured man laughed and said,
"Dearie, you are thinking too much with the left side of your brain, you are. But you are in luck. I will show you how to perform this task, yes, but first you must promise to give me what I want in return."
With no alternative, Esmeralda gave her assent. To turn the straw into gold, they took it to a nearby farmer's cooperative, where it was used to thatch an old roof. With a drier home, the farmers became healthier and more productive, and they brought forth a record harvest of wheat for local consumption. The children of the kingdom grew strong and tall, went to a cooperative school, and gradually turned the kingdom into a model democracy with no economic or sexual injustice and low infant mortality rates. For his part, the prince was captured by an angry mob and stabbed to death with pitchforks outside the palace. As new investment money poured in from all over the world, the farmers remembered Esmeralda's generous gift of straw and rewarded her with numerous chests of gold. When all this was done, the diminutive man in the funny hat laughed and said,
"Ha, that is how you turn straw into gold."
Then his expression became menacing.
"Now that I have done my work, you must fulfill your part of the bargain. You must give me your firstborn child."
Value of voice exercise. One of the most important decisions a vocalist must make involves not only finding a suitable vocal technique, but also choosing appropriate vocalizes and exercises which will develop and train the voice, as well as help maintain it to ensure a long and healthy vocal life. Eventually, the individual must take responsibility for his or her own vocal development, maintenance, and health. In the event that misuse, overuse, or some other factor should cause vocal fatigue or a more severe problem, beneficial therapeutic exercise becomes priceless. Therapeutic exercise for the body is not a new concept. Historians have traced its use from ancient times to the present, and general theories and basic principles for therapeutic exercises have developed for its use. Vocal exercise also stems from earlier centuries as a beneficial activity for general body hygiene and good health, and has developed as a training and therapy technique for the speaking or singing voice. Exercise as therapy for the voice is also not a new concept, but has not been widely used for various voice disorders. Nevertheless, sources do attest to the benefits of singing in relationship to vocal and general body health. For voice professionals to understand fully the principles and benefits of good vocal exercise, it is necessary for them to have knowledge of general exercise theories, the structure and function of the vocal folds and other parts of the larynx, the development and character of various exercise routines, and results from the exercises on the physiological and functional properties of the voice. The goal of good vocal exercise might well follow the definition of general therapeutic exercise. Therapeutic exercise is motion of the body or its parts to relieve symptoms or to improve function. It is the prescription of bodily movement in order to correct impairment, improve musculoskeletal function, or maintain a state of well-being, and it may vary from highly selected activities for specific muscles to general activities for restoring a problematic voice's peak physical condition. Specific exercises are active movements whose design seeks to restore function by strengthening particular muscle groups, mobilizing certain joints, or re-educating neuromuscular coordination. This type of exercise is of great value in the treatment of injuries and disorders of the locomotor system, where certain muscular groups and joints are affected and the rest are comparatively normal. All types of specific exercises must conform to three basic principles. They must be performed in a smooth and rhythmical manner so that they do not subject muscles and joints to sudden unexpected stresses and strains. They must be based on sound starting positions. They must provide smooth progression from the stage of extreme weakness to the stage of full use against the stresses of normal working conditions. The family huddled on the platforms, silent and fretful. The water was 6 inches deep in the car before the flood spread evenly over the embankment and moved into the cotton field on the other side. During that day and night, the men slept soddenly, side by side on the boxcar door. And Ma lay close to Rose of Sharon. Sometimes Ma whispered to her and sometimes sat up quietly, her face brooding. Under the blanket, she hoarded the remains of the store bread. The rain had become intermittent now, little wet squalls and quiet times. On the morning of the second day, Pa splashed through the camp and came back with 10 potatoes in his pockets. Ma watched him sullenly while he chopped out part of the inner wall of the car, built a fire, and scooped water into a pan. The family ate the steaming boiled potatoes with their fingers, and when this last food was gone, they stared at the gray water. And in the night, they did not lie down for a long time. When the morning came, they awakened nervously. Rose of Sharon whispered to Ma. Ma nodded her head. "Yes," she said. "It's time for it." And then she turned to the car door where the men lay.
"We're a-getting out of here," she said savagely. "Getting to higher ground. And you are coming or you ain't coming, but I'm taking Rose of Sharon and the little fellas out of here."
"We can't," Pa said weakly.
"All right, then. Maybe you'll pack Rose of Sharon to the highway anyways and then come back. It ain't raining now, and we're a-going."
"All right, we'll go," Pa said.
Al said,
"Ma, I ain't going." "Why not?"
"Well, Aggie, why, her and me."
Ma smiled.
"Course," she said. "You stay here, Al. Take care of the stuff. When the water goes down, why, we'll come back. Come quick before it rains again," she told Pa. "Come on, Rose of Sharon, we're going to a dry place."
"I can walk."
Maybe a little on the road. Get your back bent, Pa.
Pa slipped into the water and stood waiting. Ma helped Rose of Sharon down from the platform and steadied her across the car. Pa took her in his arms, held her as high as he could, and pushed his way carefully through the deep water, around the car, and to the highway. He set her down on her feet and held on to her. Uncle John carried Ruthie and followed. Ma slid down into the water, and for a moment, her skirts billowed out around her.
Winfield, sit on my shoulder. Al, we'll come back soon as the water's down. Al.
She paused.
If Tom comes back, tell him we'll be back. Tell him be careful. Now, Winfield, climb on my shoulder. There. Now, keep your feet still.
She staggered off, through the breast-high water. At the highway embankment, they helped her up and lifted Winfield from her shoulder. They stood on the highway and looked back over the sheet of water, the dark red blocks of the cars, the trucks and automobiles deep in the slowly moving water. And as they stood, a little misting rain began to fall.
We gotta get along, Ma said. Rose of Sharon, you feel like you can walk?
Kinda dizzy,
the girl said.
Feel like I've been beat.
Pa complained. Now, we're going... Where are we going?
I don't know. Come on, give your hand to Rose of Sharon.
Ma took the girl's right arm to steady her, and Pa her left.
Going someplace where it's dry. Got to. You fellas ain't had dry clothes on for 2 days.
They moved slowly along the highway. They could hear the rushing of the water in the stream beside the road. Ruthie and Winfield marched together, splashing their feet against the road. They went slowly along the road. The sky grew darker, and the rain thickened. No traffic moved along the highway. Part 1. Studying Public Speaking in Higher Education. Maybe you've been wondering, what am I doing in this class? Why am I taking public speaking? You've been communicating for most of your life already, and you've probably been successful. You've gotten this far after all. But you can do better. Like training for a sport or mastering a musical instrument, you can improve with expert coaching and practice. The purpose of this book is to guide you as you learn how to maximize your skills and convey your ideas to others. So let's begin by exploring the process of public speaking, and then we'll get you on your feet for your first speeches. Studying public speaking. As a student in a public speaking class, you'll have the opportunity to engage other students while you strengthen your communication skills. Together, you can encourage each other and grow as public speakers. You'll be amazed at your progress within just a few weeks. At first, the prospect of speaking in public might seem scary, and you'll probably make a few mistakes. That's natural, too. But with the support of your classmates and your instructor, you'll learn how to channel your natural feelings of anxiety in positive directions, so you come across as poised, prepared, and even persuasive. At this point, you'll begin to realize that while public speaking is a personal act, it's also a social act, one involving other people. As you investigate the process of public speaking, you'll realize that it is something that well-educated, community-oriented people generally do well. In fact, the importance of speech skills was recognized as long ago as 1964, when the federal government mandated speech training in the Primary and Secondary Education Act. The ability to influence social events and the actions of other people is critical in the 21st century. Because public speaking is a social act, you should think seriously about the culture within which you're speaking. What are the traditional rules for public talk? What are the expected ways of speaking in specific situations? A pulpit sermon probably differs greatly from a locker room speech at halftime. How do listeners affect the speaker's message? Males and females? Whites and people of color? rich and poor, Easterners and Westerners, all bring a unique set of expectations to the communication context. There's a lot more to think about than your own sweaty palms and pounding heart. Such rules and cultural influences are a critical part of the speech-making process, and they also account for why public speaking is mandated as a course in higher education. The Road to Philadelphia. You cannot be, I know. Nor do I wish to see you an inactive spectator. We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them. Abigail Adams. In the cold, nearly colorless light of a New England winter, two men on horseback traveled the coast road below Boston, heading north. A foot or more of snow covered the landscape, the remnants of a Christmas storm that had blanketed Massachusetts from one end of the province to the other. Beneath the snow, after weeks of severe cold, the ground was frozen solid to a depth of 2 feet. Packed ice in the road, ruts as hard as iron, made the going hazardous, and the riders, mindful of the horses, kept at a walk. Nothing about the harsh landscape differed from other winters, nor was there anything to distinguish the two riders. No signs of rank or title, no liveried retinue bringing up the rear. It might have been any year, and they could have been anybody, braving the weather for any number of reasons. Dressed as they were in heavy cloaks, their hats pulled low against the wind, they were barely distinguishable even from each other, except that the older, stouter of the two did most of the talking. He was John Adams of Braintree, and he loved to talk. He was a known talker. There were some, even among his admirers, who wished he talked less. He himself wished he talked less, and he had particular regard for those, like General Washington, who somehow managed great reserve under almost any circumstance. John Adams was a lawyer and a farmer, a graduate of Harvard College, the husband of Abigail Smith Adams, the father of four children. He was 40 years old, and he was a revolutionary. Dismounted, he stood 5 feet 7 or 8 inches tall, about middle size in that day, and though verging on portly, he had a straight-up, square-shouldered stance and was, in fact, surprisingly fit and solid. His hands were the hands of a man accustomed to pruning his own trees, cutting his own hay, and splitting his own firewood. In such bitter cold of winter, the pink of his round, clean-shaven, very English face would all but glow, and if he were hatless or without a wig, his high forehead and thinning hairline made the whole of the face look rounder still. The hair, light brown in color, was full about the ears. The chin was firm, the nose sharp, almost bird-like. But it was the dark, perfectly arched brows and keen blue eyes that gave the face its vitality. Years afterward, recalling this juncture in his life, he would describe himself as looking rather like a short, thick Archbishop of Canterbury. As befitting a studious lawyer from Braintree, Adams was a plain-dressing man. His oft-stated pleasures were his family, his farm, his books and writing table, a convivial pipe and cup of coffee, now that tea was no longer acceptable, or preferably a glass of good Madeira.